Good evening, everybody, and welcome back to another episode of The Bog right here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell. Make sure to go over to our Patreon at patreon.com/The Bog. Before we get started, a shout out to our boy, the Iron Age Jodish. Make sure to go over to facebook.com/The Iron Age Jodish and go check out some authentic Vedic astrology. Tell him Big Dave sent you. Tonight we have a really, really awesome topic. We're going to talk about the mysteries of the endless seas. We're going to talk about Njord. We're going to talk about all of the stuff pertaining to the ocean, because the ocean and maritime life were a big part of our ancestors' life and understanding of the world, and more specifically to the Scandinavians. And with us tonight we have the entire Bog panel, Tristan, Ian, and Andre, and we're going to talk all about it. And Mr. Andre, you know a little something about the sea and the Scandinavians' view of the sea, right?
Yes, I absolutely do. Personally, I grew up pretty much right next to the sea. I grew up on an island, and that's the same island that my father grew up on, and my grandfather and my great-grandfather. It's pretty far back. Of course, that's nothing compared to, like, the historical sense, I guess, in this. Like, this, these were after the Christian conversion, of course. I want to say that, in general, the coastal areas of Scandinavia have a different feel and a different reputation compared to a lot of the rest of Scandinavia, basically. It's a lot more wild, it's a lot more rural, and it's a lot more untamed in a sense. And I want to believe and I want to think that historically the ancestors of the Scandinavian people, the Vikings, the Norse, the Bronze Age people who lived there and so forth, had a very similar relationship to the coast, in that it was definitely in its own way beautiful, but also wild and dangerous.
Incredible. So tell us about kind
of... Well, I think that's very much the case.
Yeah, so...
Would you say, Tristan?
Go ahead.
I was saying that I think that's very much the case. I mean, we know of rituals attested to in the sagas in which when they would put out to sea, they'd have oak trees carved up as ritual components to Thor to ask for his protection, and they'd drop it in the water. So definitely the sea was both dangerous and invaluable to them, or something paramount in their mind.
And also, historically speaking, most settlements, especially of settlements of large size, were constructed almost right next to the ocean. It was no secret that the Scandinavians, especially in places like Norway and Denmark, were extremely reliant on the sea, especially in Norway, simply because you cannot traverse the country by normal means. Traversal off Norway was more or less impossible until we invented dynamite and managed to blow holes in the mountains. Other than that, you basically had to row or sail where you wanted to go, and that lifeline was the coast.
Well, in a lot of ways, it was just faster anyway, right? I mean, your choice was, like a 3-day boat voyage, or you could spend a month trekking over a mountain range and through a forest or something like that. For most of Norway, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, even the Kievan Rus and whatnot, even though they're in the heart of Eastern Europe, they still chose to take their boats down rivers because it was faster than, riding horses or walking.
Well, I mean, that's another thing we don't really think of today, is that water was considered in the ancient world almost like the highway of the ancient world. They viewed it as an artery that connected people and things.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And speaking of the waterways, I mean, there's been...
Well, I mean, especially, I mean, Tristan and I both have some experience with, like, the Pacific Ocean and whatnot. And while it's a very different ocean than the Atlantic, I do like how a lot of the same qualities in the ocean, regardless of where you are or what kind of topography like it is, whether it's a cold like Arctic type of ocean or more of a southerly one, a lot of the same religious themes can be found worldwide when it comes to deities associated with the sea and with sea life and concepts of water in an elemental almost like a philosophical sense rather than just a literal elemental sense.
Yeah, I would agree in that sense that Well, there's, of course, there's differences in things like climate and oceanography and the biology that you can find, the biospheres in the different seas, of course. But there's a lot of uniformity. There is not that much difference between the Pacific and the Atlantic in that, in the broad sense of things. It would be hard to know when you truly crossed over unless you actually have a map.
Well, I mean, there is a continent between them, so there's that, but I get you.
No, but if you sail between the continents, I mean, there's, you don't, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
So if you're just dealing with the water and you don't quite know where you are, you would be hard to, hard-pressed to be able to tell it. But I, for our purposes, I think the focus in this case is the Atlantic, and more specifically, for the Scandinavians, it was the North Sea. The North Sea being almost legendarily treacherous.
Now, you mean specifically the area between Denmark, Norway, and the British Isles, or do you mean like beyond that to the
specifically that area up onto up? I want to include the areas up to Iceland too. Despite the fact that that's technically considered a second ocean by itself, but it's the climate is somewhat similar. It's somewhat harsher though in between Great Britain and Scandinavia. It's an incredibly treacherous and dangerous sea with extremely unpredictable weather, very tall waves. No matter the time of the year, actually, it can be completely still almost in wind, but due to the ocean currents in the area, you can regularly get extremely large waves.
How do you think that impacted the oceanic gods of our ancestors, you know, specifically with Nord and Aegir? Do you think it affected their temperament and how we perceive them?
Well, that's one of the things I wanted to touch upon, is that when you look up just basic searches and basic questions about who, in this case, if you ask someone about Greek mythology, and they ask them, who's the ocean god? They're going to say what?
Oh, Poseidon.
Yes, of course. But who's the ocean god in Norse mythology?
Well, you see, that's a lot more contradictory or complicated. Most people would say Njord, but there's also the position of Aegir or Ran.
Well, yes. Is it Aegir an enemy of the gods?
But I would say that... No. Well, he invites them to his hall and whatnot, and aren't his daughters the mother of Heimdall?
There is a theory that he's the an enemy of the gods, which is maintained by Rydberg and certain people who adhere to his theories.
Well, I want to... like, I think this is an interesting topic of conversation, because personally for me, I would consider them both ocean gods, but Njord is definitely of the divine lineage, as he is attested to being one of the Vana gods.
Well, the way I've always seen it too is like in for the Greek or the classical parallel, Poseidon is like the god of the sea, but he's also got a lot of associations that kind of almost mark him specifically with like the coast, because, you know, earthquakes, horses, and a lot of like human activity related to the water. Whereas like the god of like the ocean, or like the embodiment of the ocean, is Pontus or Oceanus. And I would say that almost in a sense, Aegir or Aegir is the god of the deep, like the deep sea, or the personification of like the open ocean. But Njord is the god of the sea as it pertains to maintaining life and, you know, how humans and animals interact with it.
Well, I mean, you do have to also keep in mind that Aegir is fundamentally one of the Jotnar. He's not one of the gods, though he may be allied to them.
They are kind of like elemental forces by nature.
I wanted to mention that, as Njord is of the Vana lineage, so he has divine lineage, and Aegir is a Jotun. And Jotuns, I'm not sure if I would want to call them directly, like, you know, gods, the way we typically see them, as much as he's the direct manifestation of the ocean itself, while Njord rules directly over the aspects of the ocean that humans have a limited degree of control over. That's why, for instance, Aegir could be considered be an evil deity, much the same way that the ocean, at least, has historically been considered evil at times.
Well,
I can say...
Caring, right?
What?
Well, more in the sense of, like, they're not, like, evil, like malevolent, but just kind of cruel and uncaring, totally apathetic.
Yeah, I mean, you have the typical trope that you see in, like, you know, pirate movies and books and so forth. You know, the Yara, the ocean, be a harsh mistress, that type. The ocean is an unpredictable, very unpredictable thing. It's an entity that you have very little control over, and as a result, it has a lot of charm. And for the people, I can say by experience, having had family who have worked the sea for literal generations now and had lost people to the sea, there's no resentment. The sea isn't an enemy, but it's not a friend directly either. It's
almost like the forest in a way, in that sense, right?
It's there, and it's a chaotic aspect of nature that humans have no control over, because you can burn down a forest. Try getting rid of the sea.
Right, and I think to go into that, some of the depiction of the ocean can be seen in Aesir's wife, Ran, who is considered a bit malefic, almost malevolent, hateful towards humanity, but of course, she also captures dead sailors and those who die at sea, and they have an afterlife in her hall.
I was going to say, it almost seems kind of like maybe not a selfish thing, but it's like as if she were to look upon, you know, Folkvanger or Valhalla and be like, you know, I want that. You know, I want something like that. And so she casts her net out to take, you know, the drowned
for her own hall,
in a way.
I'm actually not sure about that. I get the feeling that it's in a way she's malevolent in the sense that, well, her name could be translated as literally as robbery. It's still the same word used in modern Scandinavian languages. The word Iran means robbery.
Right, I mean, we can't say for sure that Egil Skallagrimsson was very predisposed to seeing her as malevolent, though, of course, his son was taken from him in a drowning incident, so that might
come
with his perspective.
But an interesting aspect of, according to that, though, is the concept of the draugr. The malevolent spirits usually seem to, at least in more recent times, I suppose, like more modern folklore for us, were usually people who had drowned at sea.
I was going to ask you about that. I had a question about the draugr.
Go ahead.
I vaguely recall you mentioning to me once that the ones that were associated with the ocean or that were drowned had different characteristics than other kinds. Could you elaborate on that, please?
Well, in a way that, at least somewhat historically speaking, the notifications that we have of the draugr who are more typical, like those who died dishonorably and so forth. They were like, you know, the restless spirits. And they were able, they looked more human-like. Except there was something off about them. There was something off about their eyes. Their eyes looked lifeless and dead. And they also had magical powers. They could grow to tremendous sizes and so forth. But it seems, according to at least our folklore, I'm not going to speak for the case of, for instance, Sweden or Denmark. I couldn't really find much on that. I'm not even sure they have the same stories that we do. Might be a logistical issue. The draugr who come from the sea are definitely more malevolent. They are spiteful, they're angry, they're aggressive, and they also bear the marks of having been at sea. Their skin is waterlogged, it's white and bluish in tint, their hair is wet, they're constantly dripping, and they are out for revenge on anyone and anything.
I hate to make the comparison, but so then they basically kind of look like the Davy Jones guys from the Pirates movie?
In a way, but less animal.
But more like corpse. Like undead, kind of?
More just undead corpse, waterlogged corpse.
Ooh, all right. That's gross. Nice.
And another mythological figure that we have that seems to go way back, because there's no record when he just appeared. He just kind of appeared. So it's he's just called Draugen, not a draugr, but a draugen, which basically just means the draugr. Like, he's the draugr.
So he's like the king or something?
It's not really clear if he's the king or anything. But he seems to have a tremendous amount of power. He's seen as a dead person, like a skeletal face, a waterlogged body. He wears fisherman's clothing or a net. like a fishing net on his body, and he also sails half a boat. That's an important aspect. It's a half a boat. It's cut in half.
Is that like a symbolic thing related to the fact that it's like related to death, or
it's related to death, and it's also related to the fact that this guy's not natural. And if you see him, you better get close fast, because if you don't, he's going to claim you.
Gotcha.
So I'd like to move on a bit and talk about the Indo-European connections. But what creates the notion of a an ocean god, considering that if we go back far enough, the Ur-Hamat of the Indo-European peoples, was it actually connected to an ocean other than the Black Sea?
But, I mean, not to be contradictory, but wouldn't the Black Sea be enough to factor into their mythology at least a bit?
Well, perhaps. I mean, that's a good thing to discuss here. The Black Sea is more like, because it creates an isthmus between what eventually became Byzantium. So it doesn't really have as much of the properties of a normal ocean as it is just a really huge lake.
True, yeah, it's also notoriously placid.
Right.
I think it would just like... this sounds like a really lazy point to make in a sense, but if you are an ancient people who do, you know, truly believe that, you know, the gods control things like the powerful forces of nature, or they rule over specific aspects of nature, and then you come to this really weird, strange-looking vast expanse of virtually nothing that simultaneously crushes rocks, that is teeming with life... and even more, you know, it's teeming with life in the air, it's teeming with life in the sea. The seas can sometimes be still, sometimes it's extremely dangerous and destructive. Also, the water is salty. It's not drinkable.
And it smells very distinctly. You can come up upon it and know that you're there.
Yes, and you can keep following the coastline. If you just, you know, you can start in Spain and just go up the coast, and you're going to end up in Denmark, and you're still not going to be done.
You can end up in, like, Siberia.
Yeah, more or less, until you finally stop.
Well, you know, kind of something that's always been interesting to me is I think maybe true of a lot of, you know, people with Nordic heritage, you know, coastal peoples. I kind of get anxiety when I'm inland for too long or too far. Like, the very first time I was more than a few hundred miles away from the ocean, I legitimately had a panic attack because I felt... like disconnected from, like, if I needed to get somewhere fast, I couldn't get there because I'm not by a coastal settlement or anything. So, like, I mean, I know you mentioned that in the beginning, but I just kind of thought of that when you mentioned it just now.
Well, at least for me, like, personally, I completely relate to that feeling, because especially if I'm dealing with things like forests and mountains, I get this immense feeling of claustrophobia.
Yeah, I understand that. Especially, like, the Siberian taiga, where the trees are real thick and tall, gets dark at, like, 3 p.m.
Yeah, or like, you know, just, you know, the Alps. Just fuck the Alps. I can't deal with that.
Oh, you see, I'm almost on the opposite of that, but that's probably because I grew up during England, like, a mountainous climate. I actually really like the mountains and the forests and whatnot.
I like mountains and coasts both, so it's all good.
But
to me.
In a way, I want to, like, try to make the notification, like, we mentioned with the Indo-Europeans, like, this idea of the ocean being, you know, it's strange, it's different, it's new. And I think it makes sense for them to, like, you know, have a god that is ruling over that sphere, because, like, let's use Njord as an example. He's part of the gods. He's an important figure of the gods, but fundamentally, considering the fact that he's actually one of the Vanir gods, he's not the same.
He's kind of strange and new.
Kinda. He's like a stranger.
Yeah. You know,
someone's the stranger here. It might be him, it might be the other gods, it might be the Asa gods, but someone's a stranger, and he's a different type. And I get the feeling that, for at least, like, for instance, for Poseidon and Neptune, they're a bit different as well. They're a bit stranger than, say, their brothers, in some regards, I want to say.
You know, I mean, Hades gets a bad rep in Greek mythology, but I would say Poseidon is arguably far crueler.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. I mean, his cruelty is recounted in several different myths, and Hades is never actually considered cruel so much as it's sort of a taboo word they've come up across with, you know, because they fear death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not even a name, really. It's a title.
Yeah, I just think that it's just the fact that he's a god of death that gives him a bad reputation. But he's a god of death. Poseidon kills people.
Right. I mean, that's what I was going at. Hades never does anything to be cruel. He doesn't walk around killing people or giving people plagues or harming people or, you know, politicking or anything of that sort. Poseidon pretty much does all of that stuff.
You know, and raping people and turning into bulls along the way.
Yeah, or just, you know, create like several hundreds of just sea monsters and just unleash them on people because it felt like it.
Hey, without that, we wouldn't have the Odyssey, and that's a pretty good story.
Yeah, of course. You know, he did it because of the Odyssey.
Yeah, speaking of that, Andre, is there like a favorite saga that you have or something, or maybe a folk story that has to do with the sea?
That's a difficult one to answer. I mean, usually I'm pretty all-consuming when it comes to like the stories of the sea. The ones that I'm really fond of are usually like the ones that I grew up with as children aren't really like directly sagas. Like, personally, like my favorite saga, I want to say, is the saga of Egil Skallagrimson.
Okay.
That's a solid one. I like that one.
Well, why don't you give us a quick overview of some of the stories you grew up with as a, you know, living on a Norwegian island up there?
Yeah, absolutely. It was really interesting. It was only a year ago. I heard a name and there was a connection that was made here. Because out where I live, like with central Norway, the coastal areas of central Norway has, understandably, a strong presence by the coast. But we have a folklore character that keeps repeating in several smaller locations all along that area of the coast. It's just in central Norway along the coast, nowhere else. Now, this is a very specific figure, and she's a sorceress. She's a ocean sorceress that is said to live. Depending on where you're from, like out here, we have an island where she used to live. Like, that was her island. It's the tallest island in the region. That's said to be her home. And she's said to live in an invisible home that is made of driftwood covered in fishing nets and seashells.
Are you sure that's not your house?
You'd be surprised how many houses might look like that, yeah. But I'm not a sorceress,
What's
sorry.
The name of the island?
It's just called Kunna.
Ah.
Her name is Guri Kunna.
So it's her island.
It's her island, like Guri from Kunna. Kunna is the name. It's like Kunna is an old word that just means visible.
Gotcha.
It just means like it's the most visible island because there's not a lot of mountains or hills out here, so it's kind of noticeable when it's taller than that. She's said to live there. She is, as I said, she's a sorcerer and she controls the sea. Obviously, she controls the animals in the sea, and she has all the magical powers as well. As her favorite method of transportation is a quern stone, like the things
that
you
use to mind up grain.
Yes, exactly. She surfs around on a quern stone like that on the sea.
Well, that seems a little disconnected from the ocean. Is that because?
I don't know what it is.
Water-powered grain mills particularly common in the area?
Well, maybe it's because she's a witch and like she would need it for grinding up reagents for her witchcraft.
No, it's not that type of witch.
Ian, is your actual answer here? Maybe she's just a witch. She can do whatever she wants.
Yeah, basically, that's not
pretty much.
And that's honestly her personality in like a lot of the stories. If people give her shit, she's going to do some shit. And this was stories that were told in, you know, the 1700s, the 1800s, and so forth. Women didn't have power. Women didn't have authority. Women weren't allowed to speak back. But this figure, Guri Kunna, she spoke back to people, and then she cursed them, turned them into fish.
Right, flying on her quern stone, showing way too much skin. Shocking.
But she's always seen as wearing a dress. And her hair was just blonde hair with like seaweed in it.
That's a good thought. Because, I mean, if she turns them into fish and the entire community is reliant on the catch, then they end up eating their relatives.
Oh, yeah, that's another...
That has a parallel with Circe in the Greek tales, where they turn the men into pigs and then the other ones consume the pigs.
Yeah. There's no stories where they eat the fish. They just kind of like turn them into it until they're spooked and then she turned back again.
No, it's still kind of an interesting parallel. You know, they're both, you know, islands.
Well, that doesn't sound too bad. Be turned into a fish and then get turned back. I mean, you're fine, right?
Well, what if you, a shark comes up on you while you're in fish mode?
I guess that's true.
Well, if she's not satisfied with her answer, she occasionally feeds you to her cows, which are said to be cows from the sea.
Sea cows. Right,
like actual sea cows, or
cows from the sea. We don't have like dugongs and stuff like that. So
I know, I was kidding.
It's like literal cows from the sea, and they're like larger than normal, and then she's gonna like grind you up. Which I guess is where the Quernstone comes in, and then she's going to feed you to her cows.
Well, so does your island or like the surrounding coastal community, do they have any particular, I guess, theistic practices relating to any kind of maybe holdover from the pagan days of Njord? Or
well, they definitely did, actually. Up until I was looking around for sources and actually tried to ask a few like academics and the experts of the field around here, and there was some notes here that along the southern parts of Norway, there were traditions up that lasted well into like the 1800s, middle of the 1800s, that we know of, where they would throw out the first fish of the year, the first catch of the year. And they would say that, you know, they offered this up to the ocean god, in quotation marks. It, you know, didn't have any names. It just called it like, you know, the god of the ocean god.
Mm-hmm.
For us, specifically for us, the same sorceress that I'm talking to you about here, Gyrikunna, people sacrifice to her. They sacrifice the fish to her.
You know, that's funny. It almost reminds me of the Lovecraftian, you know, the Innsmouth Deep Ones thing, where they just have their ocean god and it's a community of fishermen. They sacrifice some of their fish to their ocean god. That's kind of nondescript in that way.
It was similar. It was a similar tradition, though, to what I told. What I told you about, like, they threw the fish into the sea and it was considered per catch. Like, you were supposed to give up the first catch. Sometimes it was the first catch, first fish of the year that you got, or it was the biggest of the catch. If you caught a bunch, you were supposed to offer up the last and the biggest or something like that. It varied somewhat.
Well, you know, that has some historical precedency, considering that we know it's recorded that in Sweden during the early 1900s or the beginning of the 20th century, that it's recorded old people would still bless bless Njord to what they called Njord, as you know, a degenerated form of Njord, but they offered him praise for when they would go out fishing and make catches and stuff like that. Yeah, and that's in Sweden as well.
I found some similar stories to that. Like they would bless their ships, like the boats, in the name of the god, like, you know, the name of the god Njord, and that seems like a pagan practice to me.
No,
well, there's also the issue that, you know, sailors in general are reputed to be particularly superstitious and even have quasi-pagan beliefs, and that general idea carried on for hundreds of years, right through the age of sail and everything.
What is Davy Jones if basically not a masculine form of Ran?
Well, I mean, that's very true, though he probably does seem to have some traits of that Draugen we were talking about.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
What last thing I wanted to touch upon regarding that ocean sorceress, though, that I like the connection that I was talking about that I made, is that she seems, the fact that she's a blonde, beautiful ocean sorceress with a connection to nature, as well as, you know, obviously agriculture, because he sails around on the goddamn Quernstone. Interestingly enough, one of the largest islands nearby, which has had people living on it since the early Iron Age, I believe it was, is literally called Freya.
Oh, really?
It's literally called Freya. It's like just dead ass just called Freya, with a, you know, of course, you know, with the Scandinavian instead of the E. But I thought that was an interesting connection, because that's exactly around the area, the vicinity where she was known. Some people would want to argue that this name doesn't mean what it, you know, What I think it means is that it means just far out, like far away, the island far away. Personally, I'm not sure I buy that, especially with the connection of, you know, this ocean sorceress.
Well, you know, that's rather interesting you mentioned that, because not only is Freya the you know, the daughter of Njord, the sea god, but also one of her names is Mardoll, which is often translated as sea brightener, but may also mean the one who makes the sea swell.
And then there's also the association of Frey with ships. I mean, one of his
treasures. That's true. He owns Skidbladnir. Exactly.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which is like the most legendary ship.
And as far as we know, we don't have any like written records, because this was, you know, a very small location far out on the coast of, you know, central Norway. It wasn't really like important for the great kings and the sagas to be written down. But the name Freya seems to be very old. It just happened. Like, people just always called it that. Yeah. And we know that at least on the other island right next to Freya, there has been smaller, like, religious, I don't want to call them complexes, but like small locations that seems to have been like somewhat sacred, like with some limited runic inscriptions, for instance, and also seemingly haphazard objects stacked up in piles and ponds and so forth, which seems to be designated, it seems to might have been designated as a cult spot. And this was also one of these areas where the Vana gods were in high regards. I mean, Njord was, I don't think I'm making an understatement when I say that Njord was probably like one of the most important gods for Norway.
Oh, certainly.
That kind of makes sense. And also, as far as I know, it's probably similar. It was similar with Sweden too. And the kings of Norway and Sweden claimed descent from Njord directly.
Right, especially in Sweden, the specific cult of Freyr was held in extreme prominence, and we actually know there might have been some sort of cultic tension between him and the cult of Thor and Odin, specifically through place names. We could find that certain types, like certain of the gods, were worshipped more prominently in areas in which the cult of Freyr held dominance, such as Skathi was particularly worshipped, and also Uller as well, during areas of that.
Yep. And at least in Norway, there's a lot of place names that seems to bear a resemblance to Njord, or Agir, actually, but mostly Njord. So,
to go back to what Tristan was saying earlier with the Indo-European connection, it seems that Norway and, you know, the more coastal areas of Scandinavia in general have more of an inclination towards, you know, the Vana gods, which, you know, in a historical way would make sense, because if the, you know, the Asa gods are, you know, the ones coming from the east, the, you know, the proto-Indo-European ones, that when those, you know, Neolithic already people living by the sea, you know, are assimilated and become one with these, you know, conquerors from the east, then it's almost
I would fully reject the notion that the Vana gods are representative of an archaic Indo or
Native tradition. I'm not saying that it's I'm just saying, like, if you were even from the lens of like an atheistic scholar or something, you can clearly see the parallels and why, you know, sea dwelling peoples would trend to the Vana gods.
All right. I mean, that also just has to do with the way people spread out. I mean, as we were talking about, the sea is a vehicle and artery for colonization and travel. So if you're coming from a culture or a tribe that worships the Vana gods, then, or holds them in high esteem, basically, then you're going to naturally be able to settle and colonize areas all along the coast, because that's
right.
What you use as your own transportation method.
Yeah. The interesting thing too is that the Vana gods are, you know, usually associated with fertility and you know, like life in itself, and the ocean really is kind of the primordial ooze in a sense. I mean, Andre, that's your favorite.
Well, you know, that's rather interesting that we bring that up with what they're associated with, because it's often mostly primordial concepts in general, like Njord is the god of the sea, Freyr is the god of the sun, Delingr is the sun, is also a sun god. There's also his son Dagr, which is the day. There's Njord's sister Njörthis, which is the earth, Njord, and you know, they have her mother was not his knight. I mean, so we see all this like primordial concept tree that's embodied in nature itself.
definitely.
Yeah, all the, like it. I think you're right there, because the Asa gods, to some degree at least, seem to be more imbuing the ideas of things like human creation and concept, like human concept, civilization, and so forth. Well, the Vana gods were definitely somewhat more natural, and I think, historically speaking, Denmark, for instance, was a somewhat influenced by mainland Europe, in that it was, I don't want to call it advanced at the time, but like somewhat more advanced in a civilization. Okay,
you can call it advanced.
Historically, the Danish have been full of themselves. We're just
that's not even historical. Tristan, that's not even historical. The Danes are still god-awful.
Anyway, so as you were saying about other things, Andre.
What I was saying is that for Norway, the concept of Njord as at least one of their patron gods, I wouldn't want to call Njord, in this case, a patron god of Norway, simply because a lot of people underestimate and understate how much Norway fucking sucks when it comes to agriculture. It's a bunch of forest, mainly pine wood, so you can, you can use the lumber, but it's really inaccessible. It's full of mountains. Arable land that you can use for agriculture is very scarce. So settling on these godforsaken islands with very little resources on them seems like a retarded choice to make for any sort of, sensible people. But in the case of Norway, you absolutely have to. Fish, the boons of the sea, the lifeblood of the very nation, trade and fish is what kept Norway alive. And raiding. A lot of raiding. Mainly fish.
Raiding and fish.
Norway. Well, I mean, that's another aspect to Njord that doesn't often get brought up, is especially in connection with his son Freyr, is that he's often associated with material wealth and prosperity, and also priesthood, temples. He owns himself a temple, and when Odin handed out titles to his court, he was with Freyr and Freya given the title of the Dyar, the priests, sacrificial priests and judges.
Well, a lot like Thor, he's also heavily associated with like hallowing, right? And consecrating things.
Yeah. Now, water is sacred for hallowing. So using water to clarify and to sanctify an area, I'm pretty sure that's well attested as like a ritual practice. In more religions and more locations than just Europe and the Norse faith and so forth, there's usually water. Well, I mean,
generally speaking, even in an international context, water, whether the ocean or as a river or a lake, is often seen as a liminal space between here and the afterlife or the realm of the gods or some other supernatural portal.
Water is transformative, absolutely.
Yeah. So it just makes me think in this case, like for instance, yes, a pond and so forth. It's kind of like a mirror image, like a portal into the other world. It's like a magical thing. And an ocean is just a big pond, after all.
I don't know about that. I don't really worry about sharks and krakens and stuff when I go in ponds. I worry about geese, but not other stuff.
Well, you have leeches and so forth. Sharks are just big leeches. Prove me wrong.
Why don't we talk about krakens for a moment? Go ahead, Andre.
Something I think we've talked about in the past, but I would love for you to flesh out. You know, people say, skeptics and idiots will say, well, krakens don't exist. It's a mythological creature. A giant squid, a giant Pacific octopus, literally that's a kraken. Okay. Anyway, would you say that it's fair, especially given, I guess, how common they are? Would you say that it's fair to associate the kraken as almost a totemic animal related to a sea god like Aegir or Ran, maybe Njord, maybe not Njord, but definitely Ran?
That is a absolutely beautiful question. honestly, if you were an ocean god yourself, you'd want to choose something like that to be the harbinger and the avatar of yourself, like that's your chosen animal on this plane of existence. A giant squid the size of an island is the perfect manifestation of any sort of ocean god.
I like sperm whales, but I get where you're coming from.
The sperm whale, of course, yes, you know, but it makes sense too, because sperm whales are big, but, you know, as we know, the kraken is also said to be, you know, it's big. And octopus and squids and so forth, if you look at them, they're really fucking strange. They don't look like they belong here at all.
I mean, little known fact about me, I am absolutely terrified of octopi, because I've seen them in the water when they go swimming and they grab stuff like a shark out of the water. It's terrifying. They have these sharp little beaks and they hunt.
It's cool, though.
Well, like, it's cool, but I have to agree with Tristan somewhat. And I would call any person that doesn't at least get somewhat uneasy in the presence of an octopus or a squid, they'd be fucking stupid.
Wow.
Okay. It's so weird. The animal itself is weird. I mean, strange.
If it's like a Humboldt squid or something, then yeah, I'll be a little nervous. But if it's like some little octopus that's not poisonous, and like a blue ring, then I will speak
from personal experience, because at least like in the city of Trondheim, they do have the preserved, I wanted to say skeleton, but that's not accurate at all. They have the preserved corpse of of the largest giant squids that washed up on shore on the coast of Norway. These fuckers are common here.
And I mean, to go back to what you were saying, Ian, I mean, it's not that I would be terrified of like some little 2-foot octopus floating around on the seafloor, right? Like, that's perfectly fine. They're cool. But we're talking about like the pack hunters that like grab stuff and rip it apart and everything.
Well, like the Humboldt squid that you know, drowns people.
Yeah, the Diablo Rojo in Spanish, because it, like, I've heard stories.
Yeah, devilfish.
I've heard stories from Sonorans that, you know, they say, oh, you know, my cousin's, you know, fishing partner literally got pulled into the water because like their boat tipped over and one of their tentacles tripped his ankle or something. Because they're actually really aggressive. They do attack people. Like the whole man eater thing is a little exaggerated, but people have been bitten and, you know, they get scars from the
I mean it's very difficult for an octopus to actually kill someone with a bite like a shark would, but they can grab you and drag you under.
I want to clarify that, because the octopuses and such that you want to be careful about are not necessarily the big ones, because we're dealing with the blue ringed octopus down in Australia and so forth. Yeah, that one's tiny. It's tiny, and if it bites you, you're dead within 10 minutes.
You got like 3 minutes, right? Or
up to 10 minutes. But usually, if you get bit by one of them, you're already in the sea. And you're going to instantly fall into cramps, and you're going to drown.
Yeah, so just don't go in the water unless it's in a longship.
Good rule of thumb, just stay in a longship, and also don't go to Australia. Australia wasn't made for people.
Yeah, pretty much everything in the Southern Hemisphere is spooky and evil, so I don't want to mess with it. Hyperborea time.
I will not allow you to put up the conspiracy theory that Australia actually exists.
Oh. Okay. Yeah, that's medieval claptrap, just like high Brazil. I'm not having it.
Right.
But I guess that answers your question there, Ian. I guess the squid itself, like the Kraken, the idea of the Kraken being a manifestation of an ocean god makes perfect sense to me.
I find it kind of annoying that a lot of people associate the Kraken with Poseidon because of pop culture. It just kind of makes me exponentially.
Well, I honestly, to be fair though, I see that a lot of people actually do mention that Kraken is actually, you know, Scandinavian. But very few people seem to not really know that much about it.
So let's talk about the change in the perception of the sea between the Christian and the pagan eras. How did the Christians view the sea, and how was that very different from the pagan perspective?
I want to say, as a general rule, the ocean for Christians was a dangerous, an evil, malevolent, and unnatural place. I want to base this on the fact that they did not, for instance, allow burials at sea in the beginning, until seafaring and so forth became incredibly common, because you had to be buried in sacred ground, and it had to be done by someone who was designated to do so like a priest or a bishop and so forth. But when you're at sea, at least, like, you know, historically speaking, in this case of, you know, the age of sails and piracy and so forth, nothing of that actually happened. You were in a place, that was completely out of God's realm, basically. Land was where you were standing, but if you were at sea, you were, if you died, you had to be buried in the sea. It wasn't even land, it wasn't sacred. You couldn't bless the entire ocean to make it holy water. That wouldn't make sense. And also, you didn't have a priest on board a ship. So you had to bury it by the legislation of the captain, usually.
That's right, so unless you were basically going to preserve a corpse in a cask of rum or something like that.
Well, yeah, but, you know, only Admiral Nelson is allowed to do that.
No, or I didn't mean to distract from the, if you were going to go on with that, but I had a question regarding, I guess, actual warship and stuff of Njord.
What's the question? Like,
well, definitely. If someone in the modern day wanted to worship Njord, or, you know, make an altar in their home for it, especially if they lived inland and didn't have ready access to things like seashells or seaweed, or, you know, something that you could just go outside and find, how would you advise them to worship or to conduct ritual?
In this case, I would not advise a person living in the inlands to worship Njord in the same sense that you would, for instance, like you pay homage to Njord, like you do all the gods, of course. But I would not recommend you do like a dedicated shrine to him, because in that case, you lock an aspect of him, I suppose, in the inlands. And as far as we know, like, you know, the stories between him and his marriage, his sad marriage, his unhappy marriage to Skadi, he's not happy in the inlands, and she's not happy by the coast. They don't belong together. He doesn't belong in the inlands. You have to, like, be right next to the shore. You have to be by the sea to feel his essence. You have to feel his presence.
But didn't you say he was also the god of water? So wouldn't it apply to lakes and rivers? Or
he's not directly the god of water. He's the god of water by the coast. He's like the coastal, not open ocean, but the coastal waters, in a sense.
Yeah, me and Big Dave were having a conversation about that a couple of days ago regarding to the practices of his kindred. And I was actually arguing that if you wanted to talk about who rules over, like, rivers and lakes and that sort of thing, I would actually go for Njord's sister wife, Nerfis, or Njord.
Yes, I would agree with that, because she seems to be more of a... Well,
yeah, I would too. But I'm, also, the records of Gallic worship of an earth goddess very much like Nerthus, according to the Romans, was also the goddess of like springs and rivers and whatnot. So that would definitely coincide if you were going to use the continental Germans or their Gallic neighbors as a basis.
At least like what the very last thing I think I want to touch upon, though, is initially, I suppose, the kind of point I should have started with, though. So let's end it in the most exciting place possibly, we know, with the creation of the world. In the sense that the reason why I believe, like, the ocean and so forth, the aspect of the ocean, the worship of Njord, and the power of the ocean, the presence that it had for at least, especially the Scandinavian people, is linked to the creation myth of our faith. The creation myth, most people would obviously be familiar with it, but the symbolism behind the creation of the world and the creation of the oceans itself, I find is very interesting. In this case, right, like the giant Ymir was slain and his blood became the oceans. His blood being the vital essence that kept him alive. In this sense, the planet, the Earth itself, was given the vital essence of the primordial giant himself as its own lifeblood. I don't know what you guys think.
That is a very interesting symbology there. I've never considered that.
I spent a long time thinking about the ocean.
We know. I would agree.
Because I get the impression that things like, you know, the aspect of, you know, the lifeblood, the blood, you know, the essence of your very being itself, you know, it's kind of important. It's not something that people just throw willy-nilly around. I mean, you know that blood was used to sanctify icons and so forth, you know, in a religious context. So the blood would, you know, have a very strong prominence. And the fact that this ocean, like all the oceans of this planet, all the oceans of Midgar became the very lifeblood. And not to sound like a materialist or anything like that, the reductionist materialist, call it like that, but I find it interesting that, you know, the parallels that, you know, conventional science usually says that, you know, life on Earth did begin in the oceans. The oceans, in this case, being a literal lifeblood of our own planet. That's where it all started. That's where it all originated.
Well, yeah, that's a very, very poignant symbology there.
And I would agree just in the sense that on a biological level, the ocean and water really is the source of most food chains and really,
I mean, it's the source of every food chain, actually. I'm not kidding. Without the oceans, there wouldn't be life on this planet. The oceans generate the winds. The oceans generate rainfall so that you can grow crops in the middle of, you know, Central Africa or Central America or whatever like that. That's because of the oceans. That's because of the evaporation.
Is Njord a weather god at all? Or what? like how Thor is, or no?
Yeah, Njord is also considered to control the weather and the winds, and also fire.
I've said that before, and I've had people get kind of contradictory and angry, saying, like, no, it's chiefly the domain of Thor. And
no, but in this case, like, you know, weather god is kind of like a loose definition, because Njord controls the weather, Thor controls the weather, Freya controls the weather somewhat, Frey seems to control the weather.
Right. I mean, Odin has very strong associations with the storm and wind, especially.
Yep.
See, what I like to do when people fuck up about that topic is to remind them that the idea of a god of X is not really a Nordic cosmological principle. It's just something we slap on to make it more easily understandable. And Njord isn't the god of the ocean specifically. Njord is just Njord.
Yeah, and then also too, like in a heritage kind of sense, or like an inheritance way. I mean, if Odin is associated with the storm and his son is, you know, regarded as the god of storms, it's like you can clearly see that it's something, it's an aspect of nature that is for the Allfather to distribute rather than like an innate thing. So I would definitely agree with you there.
Well, anyway, and unfortunately we've had, you know, some technical issues on Big Dave's end, so he's not been able to join in most of this call. But we're going to head it to him to give us our outro here.
All right, excellent. Yeah, thanks, guys. I appreciate you guys. Good work. Sorry to everybody I couldn't join in, but we're having some serious delay. I just figured I'd sit out so, you know, folks wouldn't have to listen and struggle having a flow of conversation and everything like that. But we're going to take it out for this evening. Thank you guys for such an awesome conversation. And thank you, everybody, for tuning in tonight over here on DLive.tv/Dave Martell on another episode of The Bog. We got a double banger coming for you this week because we missed last week. So we got two up for you. But on our way out, I want to make sure to remind everybody to go check out our Patreon at patreon.com/TheBog. There's a tier for everybody, $5 all the way up to $50. You go check it out over there if you like to go ahead.
Oh, also, Big Dave, I'm sorry to interrupt you here, but I forgot to mention that Radden X has also donated us 2 ice creams and also 15 lemons. And it's very appreciated. Thank you, Radden X.
Many blessings.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. But yeah, go over and check out the Patreon at patreon.com/TheBog. Go check out our boy, facebook.com/IronAgeJyotish, to check out some authentic Vedic astrology. It will blow your mind. Tell him Big Dave sent you. And before we head out, we're going to give a shout out to our patrons, our most exalted patrons over on Patreon. I'm going to raise, you guys can't see me because I got my camera off, but you can just imagine Big Dave raising the horn right now. I'm raising the horn for these guys. Let me pour it up. Special hail to our brother, Corey. Thank you very much for all of your donations and all your love and your blessings and your support of the Bog. And many hails to our friends, the Allens. Hail! Ah, delicious. All right, everybody, thank you so much for tuning in. Make sure you give us a follow right here on DLive. And go over to our YouTube, over at YouTube. This is Dave Martell. We're going to switch up the branding. We're just turn it all into the Bog up here pretty soon. But make sure you go over to YouTube, like, subscribe, share, follow here on DLive, and also check it out on Patreon. All patrons get RSS feed. I upload the audio versions of all of our shows, so you can listen to it in your car, at the gym, or at work. And that's what everybody's been asking for. Now we got it for you if you go sign up on our Patreon. We got so much more stuff coming your guys' way. I can't even think off the top of my head, man. We're hard at work, us here on the Bog, and we got so much more stuff coming your guys' way. But anyway, like always, many hails, many blessings. Hail the folk, hail the gods. We'll see you guys next time here on the Bog. Hail.